You're listening to Podcast to Practice, brought to you by Springer Healthcare IME. Podcast to Practice brings you expert-led independent medical education discussions, inspiring healthcare professionals to maximize their learning and make measurable changes in their own clinical practice.
This podcast is part of an independent medical education program entitled the AML Expert Series, Innovations in Molecular Testing, Emerging Therapies and Targeted Treatments. It is intended for healthcare professionals only and is supported by an independent educational grant from Rigel.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to our independent medical education program called Unveiling the Mysteries of Molecular Testing in AML, A Guide for Oncologists, where we will be discussing the various molecular testing methods that are available and very important in the current management of patients with acute myeloid leukemia. So my name is Amer Zaidan. I'm the Chief of Hematologic Malignancies Division at Yale Cancer Center and Yale University. And I specialize in the management of acute myeloid leukemia and myelodysplastic syndromes. And it's my true pleasure to be joined today by Dr. Loghavi. Sanam, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Good morning, Amer. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. My name is Sanam Loghavi. I'm a hematopathologist and a molecular pathologist at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas.
Thank you, Sanam. So it's a real pleasure to be joining our audience today, where we'll be discussing, I think, a very important subject, which is how did acute myeloid leukemia management evolve over the last 15 years, primarily with the understanding that acute myeloid leukemia has different drivers and that targeting those drivers is important in not only in the management of patients, but it can also help in different aspects of the disease, such as understanding the prognosis and understanding the specific diagnosis. It's becoming very clear that every person who manages acute myeloid leukemia should have some kind of access to molecular testing capability, either locally or as a send out, because those decisions are becoming very integrated in how we recommend the best treatment for patients. And maybe, Sanam, maybe you can take us through how did the molecular techniques kind of evolve over the last 15 years compared to the traditional cytogenetics, which I think most people are very familiar with.
Sure. So, let's just go back a little bit in time and start with where the classification of acute myeloid leukemia was merely based on maybe a little bit of cytogenetics for, an acute leukemia like APL or the core binding factors. And then everything else was really based on immunophenotype and morphologic differentiation. And this was largely due to the lack of technologies that would allow us to understand what the genetic drivers of disease are. And then fast forward to, early 2000s is where we really started, doing Sanger sequencing routinely in the labs. And at the time, we were doing, very single gene Sanger sequencing for genes like RAS, FLT3 later. And then really, at least in our lab and, maybe a little bit in the research setting, but I would say in the clinical setting, you saw a revolution in the way we genomically characterize acute myeloid leukemias, and that is with the advent of NGS or next generation sequencing that allowed us to mass parallel sequence multiple genes in one panel. And this is, we went live with our earlier NGS panels around 2013, I think. So it's only been about 10 years where we've been doing really comprehensive NGS. And at this time, while panel testing is still the gold standard and is mostly, utilized by, I would say, the majority of the clinical labs in the in resource-rich settings, there are, the goal and the intent is to move towards whole genome sequencing, where we can characterize, the entire genome of the leukemia. And this is largely thanks to the cost of NGS and sequencing going down. So I think now we're at a very good point where we can sequence DNA and RNA at the same time to identify both somatic mutations and then driver fusions in acute myeloid leukemia, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, that are also equally as important in terms of selecting appropriate therapies for the patients.
No, that's a great overview, Sanama. I think a very important part, in addition to having the ability to do, you know, extensive testing, even including whole exome sequencing, I think is the ability to have the right expertise for people to interpret the data. And I think this is where sometimes it can get tricky for, especially for the practicing oncologist. So what would you say the bare minimum of genes that any good practice where people see patients with acute myeloid leukemia should have access to, maybe overviewing what is currently recommended in some of the like guidelines, such as the NCCN guidelines?
Sure. I think, you know, it really depends on the therapy and, you know, the prognostic systems that we're using. So if we're talking about the bare minimum, and this is, you know, far away from the ideal world, but if we're talking about the bare minimum, and if we have, you know, we're talking about a resource-rich setting where we have access to targeted therapies, really what's important to know is, first and foremost, the status of FLT3, of course, because, you know, we have targeted therapies for FLT3. IDH1 and IDH2 are important. We have targeted therapies for those. NPM1 and KMT2A rearrangements now become very important, as well as NUP98, because, again, we have the menin inhibitors, which are targeted therapies. P53, TP53 is important, not necessarily because we have targeted therapies for it, unfortunately, but because we don't have any therapies really for it. And, you know, it's probably best to transplant those patients as early as you can.
So, Sanam, that's great. So you mentioned a number of genes that are very important to kind of assist for mutations for. Of course, as oncologists, some people might not be very familiar with the specific technology that is used. You know, people talk about next-gen sequencing, PCR, whole exome sequencing, etc. So maybe you can overview some of the commonly used techniques, and are there certain techniques that are better for certain mutations, or does the oncologist kind of rely on whatever the lab recommends?
Right. I think, you know, this is a very complicated area, and thank you for asking this question. Obviously, not all technologies and panels are created equally. Even the same technologies and panels in different laboratories may have different capabilities. But I would say, there's two ways really to break these down. And one is by analyte, right? Are we analyzing DNA or are we analyzing RNA? So as a general rule, if we're looking for somatic mutations or changes in the DNA, and this includes, you know, some internal tandem duplications, potentially in you know, FLT3 or other genes, really NGS is the way to go. FLT3 is a little bit tricky because if the internal tandem duplications, and, you know, what we call internal tandem duplications, is just duplications of the wild type sequence that leads to the mutation. So if we're comparing this duplicated sequence to our reference genome, as sometimes for the longer ITDs, the NGS bioinformatic pipelines have difficulty determining or annotating these mutations. So we, in our laboratory, we complement NGS with what is called capillary electrophoresis that essentially looks for the size of the gene. So, that's your DNA. RNA is great for looking for fusion products, let's say for BCR-ABL1, for KMT2A rearrangements that lead to different fusion genes. So that's from RNA and DNA. The other thing is the sensitivity of the different assays. So if we think about traditional Sanger sequencing, the sensitivity is around 20%, meaning you need 1 in 5 cells to be mutated to be able to pick up the mutation. So if you're not seeing a mutation in a Sanger sequencing, it doesn't mean that the mutation's not there. It just means that it may be below 20%, right? Most clinical grade NGS panels have a sensitivity of about 2 to 5% if they're not error corrected. And now you know very well that we're using NGS for measurable residual disease detection as well, particularly for FLT3 and NPM1. And the way we are able to do that is by error correction. And what I mean by that is, so when you use NGS and when you use molecular barcodes to be able to subtract PCR error from the sequencing, then your sensitivity becomes much higher. And, you know, you can go down to a sensitivity of about 10 to the minus 6, which is one mutant cell in 10 million cells, right? So that's a much, much more robust technology. Even though we're sequencing DNA and, you know, the analyte is the same, the sensitivity is very different, obviously. And then the other thing, you know, this is just a very practical tip for the practicing oncologist, is if you look at most NGS reports, at the end of the report, there's going to be a long table or a long section that tells you what the coverage of this panel is, right? So let's say, for instance, most panels right now use a combination of whole entire exonic or hotspot regions. And this is really because, like everything else, NGS real estate is also important, right? So you have to think about the depth of sequencing versus the coverage of sequencing, because there's only a finite amount of sequencing that you can do. So if you want to achieve a reasonable depth, you're going to say, okay, let's say for NPM1 and IDH1 and IDH2, I know the mutations are hotspot. I know they recurrently occur in certain regions. So then I'm going to sequence a smaller portion of that gene. But then for TP53, I'm going to sequence, you know, the entire DNA binding domain, because I know the mutations happen all over the place. Similarly for TET2. So if you look at that table in the bottom of the NGS report, it's going to tell you exactly what regions of those genes were sequenced, right? So I think that's a little bit of a help, you know, if you're not familiar with reading these NGS reports. And then based on that, you can decide if, you know, that assay is adequate for what you're trying to achieve or not.
So Sanam, this might be more technical question, but you know, this, I think, an issue that comes often, and I've seen that, I have to say, early on when the IDH inhibitors, for example, were being introduced, I actually have seen where people did not even realize there was IDH1 and IDH2, and you know, the patient would have a mutation IDH1 and they would be given an IDH2 inhibitor. So I think it can get like quite tricky if people, of course, this is, I think, much less happening now these days, because I think people are kind of more familiar with these drugs and the differences. But how can an oncologist be sure that the test that they are sending you mentioned the coverage and the depth. For example, IDH inhibitors are very good drugs, and we want to test for IDH1 and IDH2 in every patient. So is next-gen sequencing adequate, or should they send a PCR, or should they ask a pathologist? I always actually have been in the opinion that, you know, you send and say this is acute myeloid leukemia, and then the pathologist can decide all the right tests rather than us kind of saying, okay, you have to do PCR for this one and next-gen sequencing for that one.
Right. So at this time, actually, you know, IDH1 and IDH2 are pretty easy to sequence because the mutations are single nucleotide variations, typically, and they're hotspot. So NGS, I would say, is adequate as long as the gene is covered in the panel, which, you know, the report should clearly state the coverage of, you know, the name of the genes that are covered in the panel. And routine clinical grade NGS is adequate for IDH sequencing. FLT3 is a little bit more tricky. I think some NGS panels are designed to be able to pick up FLT3 ITDs because there's bioinformatic correction that allows to do that. And some NGS panels are not. So you really have to pay attention to that. If the report indicates that the coverage is adequate for detection of FLT3 ITD, then the NGS assays are okay for FLT3 ITD. If not, for laboratories that don't have a good FLT3 NGS assay, they usually complement with capillary electrophoresis.
Perfect. So for specifically for testing for IDH1 or IDH2, just to recap for the audience, most of those mutations happen in specific hotspots. So the coverage for most next gene sequencing assays that are out there is probably adequate, and you don't have to get concerned too much about missing a mutation. And the level of the sensitivity goes down to around 2%, which we think is quite adequate. So I know there are PCR tests as well available for IDH 1 and 2 testing as well. But I think as part of the next gen sequencing that kind of assesses all the genes, I think it's probably adequate. Maybe we can talk about differences in the sensitivity and the specificity and the turnaround time of these, because as you know, I think some places it can take a very long time for these results to come back, and everybody's anxious, the doctor is anxious, the patient is anxious, they want to get going on treatment, especially for IDH1. Given in older unfit patients, we actually have a frontline approval for ivosidenib in combination with azacitidine. And one of the issues that gets commonly cited in terms of why people would use azacitidine is that they don't want to wait because it can take 2-3 weeks for the IDH1 mutation to come back. Of course, in addition to the lower frequency of IDH1 mutations, which is around 5%.
Of course, I think that's a great point. And in fact, I was just about to say that, so you read my mind. I think, you know, some laboratories, you'll notice that even though their NGS panel is adequate for detecting IDH mutations, they still do a single gene IDH1, IDH2 PCR because of the turnaround time. So, you know, the turnaround time for NGS is variable and really depends on the volume that that laboratory is testing, their bioinformatics setup, of course, the laboratory setup and, various things that go into the turnaround time. But it can range from 3 to 4 days for getting an NGS results all the way up to about 3 weeks to a month. So obviously, if you're, you're an oncologist and you're waiting to treat a newly diagnosed AML, you don't want to wait a month to get the IDH result back. So then, those laboratories that have slower NGS turnaround times usually complement their NGS with a PCR assay that has the ability to detect IDH1 and IDH2 mutations, similar with FLT3 sometimes for turnaround time. So I think that's very important. And then in terms of, again, sensitivity and, specificity is not much of an issue if we're looking at, especially high variant allele frequency mutations. But I think sensitivity at baseline is probably not much of an issue in a patient that's presenting, for IDH particularly. That is usually a clonally dominant mutation. I think, of course, for FLT3, which can often be subclonal, sensitivity is very important, and you want to be able to detect small clones because, if those go undetected, they can often give rise to relapse. Again, the sensitivity matters, but it depends on the context. It depends on whether we're looking for measurable residual disease versus, we're characterizing the disease at baseline.
Yeah, what we started doing in my institution at Yale is we actually have a rabbit gene panel, which turns around within 5 business days. And we selected a few number of genes that are very important, as you mentioned, such as NPM1, FLT3, TP53, IDH1, and IDH2, and some of the genes that are kind of important to designate adverse risk leukemia, such as ACXL1, RUNX1, etc. And then we have a more extensive panel that is, I believe, up to 49 genes that takes, longer. And I'm like, when you talk about the depth of coverage, is this the same as the limit of detection, like the 1 or 2%?
No. So the depth of coverage is really how many times are we sequencing? How many reads are we getting on the specific region of a gene? So the higher the depth of coverage, the lower the sensitivity, right? So let's say I'm sequencing 1,000, sequencing 1,000 reads in IDH1, and there is one mutant read. So, the mutation has truly an incidence of 1 in 1,000. So if I'm sequencing 1,000 reads, I have the ability perhaps to pick up that 1 in 1,000. But if I'm only sequencing 100 reads, if I'm only looking at 100 reads, then there's no way I'm going to be able to pick up that 1 in 1,000, right? So the deeper the sequencing is, the deeper the coverage is, the better, or, you may say higher sensitivity, but the number is actually a lower number, right? We're able to pick up a small clone in a sea of wild type cells.
Yeah, for our oncologists who, again, might get overwhelmed a little bit when you talk about, coverage and depth of coverage and sensitivity and specificity, most of the commercially available next-gen sequencing will have adequate coverage of IDH1 and IDH2 mutations, because most of those mutations happen in what we call hotspots, specific areas of the gene which are recurrently mutated. And they have enough coverage to detect clinically meaningful mutations. So it really depends on whether you have the luxury of waiting or not. If you need to start treatment sooner, you can send a PCR because that turns around faster, which is a little bit different than the FLT3 situation where there could be an issue of the detection of the mutation. Again, depending on what is the next-gen sequencing and the other supplemental techniques that the lab uses. So I think, and this is our practice, actually, we often send both PCR and next-gen sequencing for that particular situation. But I feel this is an area that always confuses people. So thank you so much for explaining all of this. And as we come towards the end of this podcast, Sanam, maybe we can talk about some of the logistical aspects of this, issues related to the sample quality. We always hear from the pathologist about the bone marrow was suboptimal or, dilute, or the sample was not good. Like, what are some of your practical hints? Of course, we can also send from the blood when they are blast, but what kind of practical hints and recommendations in terms of making sure you receive a good sample for analysis?
Sure. This really goes back to the pre-analytical issues of any type of molecular testing. We need to receive an adequately representative sample. So it's not just, whether or not that the sample is adequate, but it needs to be representative of what's going on in the bone marrow that we're trying to sequence. So at baseline and, in an initial diagnosis of AML, most of the times, thankfully, adequacy is not an issue because we're able to get an adequate amount of blasts and neoplastic cells to sequence. However, there are times where, you have a dry tap. If you're trying to save the patient from getting a bone marrow, you're sending a peripheral blood sample. If there aren't adequate circulating blasts and we're only sequencing lymphocytes, we just won't have the ability to pick up a mutation because the lymphocytes are going to be wild type. Of course, they're not part of the clone. The other issue is, I think, it's mostly post-treatment that we deal with these adequacy issues a lot, is because So when we're doing a bone marrow aspiration, the sample gets split between several laboratories. Obviously, it goes for morphologic assessment because, the pathologist wants to do a blast count. It goes for flow cytometry. Flow cytometry labs typically want either the first or the second pull. Obviously, because of sensitivity issues, they don't want a hemodilute sample because then that leads to an inadequate assessment. And so the molecular lab oftentimes ends up getting the last pull, which may be even further hemodiluted. So those are things that you want to talk about. You want to think about when you are interpreting an NGS report. It's always good to look at the corresponding bone marrow report because there's always an adequacy assessment there that says whether or not this sample was an adequate sample. I think that's very important. And again, this is a very practical, I think, simple tip. But, if something doesn't make sense in the context of what you are trying to clinically determine, it's always good to question at least, the validity of the test results and consult with the pathologist, consult with the molecular lab or whoever is interpreting that report, and provide them with information that you may have that is not available to them that may help them, better interpret those results. And I think this is just very important common sense practice to practice using every piece of information that's available to you.
Before we conclude, just one last question, or I think important because we don't operate in a vacuum, right? These cost considerations and, barriers to kind of getting this testing. And this is, I think, one of the most challenging aspects to talk about because it varies extensively across the country. And I think there are certain hospitals or certain states where it's relatively easier to do some of this next-gen sequencing. You probably don't deal on this side of things, but any recommendations to kind of make sure this works smoothly, that you would communicate to the oncologists who order these tests?
Yes, I think, you know, we actually do deal with this a lot. And so I think the most practical and simple tip I would say is please be mindful and, you know, order a test if you think it's going to alter your clinical management. Let's say for a patient that has an NPM1 mutation, doing serial NPM1 MRD is absolutely indicated. It will definitely, you know, alter the course of this patient's management. So those are the issues that I think, you know, we need to carefully document in the chart. Why are we ordering this? How is this going to alter our management?
So thank you so much, Sanam. This was excellent discussion. Maybe we can conclude by some of your main key take-home messages for our audience.
Sure. So my take-home message is, you know, we're very lucky. We practice in an era where we have targeted therapies available to our patients, and we have very robust, extensive technologies that allow us to identify these targets of therapy. So let's use them appropriately and be mindful of, you know, the variations that exist in these different assays to be able to provide the best therapy available to our patients.
Yeah, and I echo that. And I think the availability of targeted therapies with pills such as IDH1 and IDH2 inhibitors, FLT3 inhibitors, but also some of the newly evolving treatments such as the MIN inhibitors, etc. It's a very exciting era, and diagnostics, including molecular testing, is very vital to all of this development. And with that, I like to thank you so much for joining me today, and thanking our audience. And hopefully we will talk to you in the next edition of this podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Thank you for listening to Podcast to Practice, brought to you by Springer Healthcare IME. For more information on our educational programs available, visit ime.springerhealthcare.com.